Thank you for joining us on another episode of the MetaMakers podcast. I'm Davis.
And this is Dylan.
And we're here with our guest, Dr. Thomas Stanley.
AKA Bushmeat.
Yeah. Bushmeat. Could you please introduce yourself? Where did your stage name come from?
It's an idea that's about the necessity of wildness. You know, it's a term that refers to people in poor countries, especially parts of Africa, that supplement their food with things that they eat out of the wild, out of the bush, out of the jungle. And it has a negative connotation in that bushmeat includes not just animals that are plentiful, but also things that are very close to humans in terms of their consciousness, like bonobos and chimpanzees and gorillas. And, you know, a lot of animals that are needlessly destroyed because of the poverty and the political turmoil in the regions where these, you know, where these practices still maintain. So I wanted to identify with that endangered species aspect. And it's also, you know, it also ties into my concepts about evolution, human progress.
Mm. Wow. So you have a PhD in ethnomusicology.
Yep.
Could you just quickly talk about what that is?
It's basically the study of music as culture and the culture of music. And you know, it gave me an opportunity to meet and study all sorts of different music from all over the world, and to touch and handle and sometimes perform with all sorts of different instruments. You know, I've played in gamelan ensembles, I've played shakuhachi, djembe drumming, you know, lots of wonderful, wonderful opportunities. And my doctoral research was on the late Lawrence Douglas Butch Morris, who invented a method of using conduction symbols, gestures, bodily movement to actually shape improvised musical ensembles in real time. And it, you know, it's one of the most incredible ways of making music I've ever witnessed. And I had a chance to work really closely with him to get, you know, some of his ideas and some of his work documented.
Wow, that sounds really awesome.
Also got a radio show, got to push my radio show.
Yeah, what's that called?
It's called Bushmeat Jams. And what you have to do is you have to join me every Thursday night at midnight until 12 a.m. 2 a.m. Friday. Oh, I'm messing it up, man. We haven't even... And it's really like a collage that's about listening to music. It's not about any particular kind of music. It's about listening to music. Music as a particular kind of fuel for a particular kind of momentum, a particular kind of velocity along a particular kind of vector. So you have to check it out.
I took a Music of the World class in college, and I feel like I'm just right back in talking about shakuhachi and the gamelan.
That's it, man. That's it.
You're also a scholar of Sun Ra. You want to share who Sun Ra is?
Sun Ra was a celestial body that, like, you know, interrupted the normal progression of my life. Wow. And has deflected it towards some pretty amazing adventures. Sun Ra was a jazz musician, a poet, a scholar, a writer, a thinker, a teacher, and a helper. You know, he kind of came to planet Earth to help people develop. And, you know, he had a lot of ways of presenting his ideas from the stage and in talking to people. But it was basically like an idea that has to do with really accepting the challenge of progress, genuine progress, progress that's measured along a scale that's sustainable, not the progress of, you know, capitalism and consumption, and because it's not progress, you know. And, you know, Sun Ra often gets identified with the accomplishments of ancient Egypt. They called themselves Kemites. Or their land was the land of the blacks, Kemet. And really what Sun Ra was saying was, like, you know, everything we've been doing since ancient Egypt, since foundational civilization, has been the same kinds of ideas, building really big stuff, out of stones and people, institutions, ideas, ideology, and that the future is not that. The future is the exhaustion. We finally run the course. That's what late stage capitalism is about. That's what precarity is about. That's what this incipient feeling of dis-ease that permeates society is about, is that we've really exhausted all of what can be done within that basic framework of building big stuff, big institutions, and plopping them there as monuments to the dead. We're going to live for the living in the future, and that's what's going to make it different, and it's going to feel great, and we're very close to that right now.
Living the future while harnessing, you know, the tactics and everything of ancient Egyptian and things we've learned in the past, but we almost need to relearn them. You've got a lot of history.
No, I want to stop you there because I don't want to. You know, the beautiful thing about being old is you can stand on your own two feet. You know, peer pressure is whatever at this stage of the game. I've been working solo without a net for so long that, you know, I kind of don't give a fuck. No, yeah, I'm not a traditionalist. I'm not a traditionalist. It doesn't mean the tradition doesn't matter to me. It doesn't mean that there isn't great information that is of and from the past. But our responsibilities right now are not about resuscitating and reviving traditions as much as they are about creating the future, creating the premises for social consciousness that will guide us into the next 12,000 years. Wow. This is the bookend to what was accomplished at Göbekli Tepe, Potbelly Hill in Turkey 12,000 years ago. That's where we're at. It's a big change, a big change.
So how do we do that? What strategies would you give our listeners in recreating this social paradigm?
All right. Human morphology, your body, right? Skeleton, muscles, skin, all that stuff, right? It's encoded by your genome. And, you know, nutrition and experience, all of those things matter. But there's a basic format that's just written, and it's written into your body by your genes, and we don't want to take too much time in biological reproduction, but your mommy gives a set of genes, your daddy gives a set of genes, and together they write this wonderful poetry that's you. Your body, the human species body, collective, our collective body, changes very slowly over time. I don't know how many millions of years, tens of millions of years, it took just for that thumb to come around so that we could actually create and use tools. You know, the opposable thumb, man, that's a big deal. Language also informs us. Language also defines the parameters of the human body, how it's used, what it builds, what it can build, what it can't build, what it can hold in its hand, what it can't hold in its hand. If you can affect a strategic breakdown in the dynamics of language, you can change the whole thing. You can change the whole world.
That's why they call it spelling, right?
That's why they call it spelling.
It's casting spells. I always bring this up because I love music too, man. And then the voice is like a, it's the portal between the thoughts, like the ethereal, and the material, the real world. And so by speaking, I mean, in the Bible, without getting too religious, you know, keeping it spiritual, it said in the beginning was the word. And the original word was logos.
That's right.
In Greek, and that word means vibration.
That's right. Where we're at, and there are a lot of things pushing in the same direction. You know, I saw someone sent me an email that I think it was it Denver that recently legalized psilocybin?
Is it legal or decriminalized?
Decriminalized, excuse me. There's a big difference.
Pushing the boundaries.
There's a big difference. And I think there's another place where there's, you know, some legislation that's working its way through, you know, a proposition, a referendum. So there's a lot of things that are pushing us in the direction of where language emanates from the cosmos, not just our intentionality, but things that we're not really intending are pushing us to really see where language erupts out of the cosmos. That's one of the gifts, I think, of psychedelics, is that it peels back culture and language to a place where you can see the world really fresh. Now, I work with a kind of music that some people wouldn't even dignify with the term music. And I don't go out of my way to defend it as such. You know, I call what I'm doing, we love coffee. That's my favorite alkaloid, actually. Caffeine, right on.
You just got a coffee delivery right on. Podcast.
Yes, please.
It's all about chemistry in the end, isn't it? I work with a kind of music that, and I borrowed this idea really from Butch Morris. When Butch was in Vietnam, and you could imagine what kind of war that was, right? He worked as a medic, and his specialty was prosthetics and orthotics. You know, when you got that limb blown off, he was the guy that replaced it, right? So I consider what I make with sound as an oral or an acoustic or a sonic prosthesis. It's a thing that you will insert into your body through your ears to make your consciousness work better, to make your awareness function at a higher level, and to parse time. It's all about time too, baby.
Yeah.
And to parse time in a way that's more beneficial to you. I'm on your side. I'm not giving you something that's going to hurt you. I experimented on myself with all this stuff.
You took it before you
like
decided Shulkin, to release
baby,
it.
Like Shulkin, baby, like Sasha, you know? So it's difficult work. It's difficult work. I'm raising kids. You know, I'm trying to maintain family and sanity like everybody else. It's difficult work. So anyhow, I'm lucky in Washington, D.C. because I work in community. I work in collaboration with, like, every day I'm getting emotional. I appreciate more the community that I work with. I'm going to kind of avoid dropping names because if I leave a person out and I hear it on air, I'm going to feel terrible that I didn't mention and I didn't mention and I didn't mention. But beautiful, beautiful artists that are functioning below the level of, you know, commercial remuneration, if I said that properly. You know, money, bucks. People that are obviously not doing it to get rich because they're not on the path of riches. Mm-hmm. And yet they're pouring their essence, you know, what it means to be alive. That's what they're putting into their art. And I'm a part of that. That's a huge privilege. And look at where we are, man. This is Washington, D.C. You know, we are the sleeper operational combat cell. You know, we're right here on the ground working nonviolently, but we're termites. We're not carpenters. We're not adding to this shit. This shit is over. We're trying to recycle it, get it out of here. Like the little microbes.
Regenerate.
Yeah, man. Just chew it up. Turn all of this symbolic excess, all of these signs and regulations and language. Oh my gosh, everything is put in place with language. You have to create fluidity. You have to put it all back into solution. And it takes strong art to do that. So I'll mention a place, since I'm not going to mention individuals, but the folks at Rhizome DC, that has become a really important site of production and regeneration for me. You know, a place to go and get healed and a place to go and present my work to an appreciative audience.
So where is Rhizome? Can you explain a little bit about it? Because we are here actually in Tacoma. What is your history with them?
It's on Maple Avenue, and you have the internet in front of you, so don't make me try to remember. It's 1200. Oh, I can almost see it. And it's right. No, I won't mention the commercial landmarks because that would be ugly. But it's right there. Big white house that's beautiful. And it's just run by a collective. And the first floor is a performance space and a kitchen, some chairs. And upstairs is a gallery. Yeah. And it's a real, you know, like the last time I was there, the art that was being shown upstairs was all work, amazing work that had been done by incarcerated people.
And it's another third place for people to go and connect. You know, Davis and I have been, you know, hearing so many about spaces in D.C. that we want to help. And it's like, it's the glue that's going to connect the third places, I think, is what's going to be powerful. And, you know, creating that language to connect these, you know, spaces where people connect so that they can be more and more effective. How would we do something like that?
I'm thinking, you know. You know, a lot of it is the architecture of intimacy is what makes the things that happen within rhizome feel natural, organic, unrehearsed. So if you can kind of create that kind of intimacy within a network, you know, create the feeling of being close in the same room together, of being able to have conversation at various levels of formality, I think you can get people to invest in that family way, which is the way that things work, you know, like family businesses and family farms. You know, I'm all about that. I like that. Because, you know, you believe in that, you know. And people do so much that they don't believe in. And that's like, what is that? Is that half the problem? No, that's like 99% of the problem. People are doing a whole bunch of stuff that they don't really, you know. How could you believe in that? If you really thought about it, no, nobody believes in any of that stuff. Really. You know, so human life is wasted because, you know, between the state and religious ideology, we're conditioned to kind of pour it in the toilet. And it's so beautiful and brief. And we're worried about, like, you know, the hereafter and, you know, whatever for the here and now. And it's sad. It's really, really sad. The happy part of it is imagining it changing. The happy part of it, you know, look, like I said, I stand alone a lot. And I don't always use or defer to the argot of the new left. Okay? And that's you guys. Young activists with your podcast. Right on. Right on, right on, right on. Intersectionality to me is the idea that we're all kind of committed in struggle along fronts that are defined primarily by our identities. And if we're lucky enough to have a cool identity, like, you know, we're black or we're female or we're gay or we're this or we're that, then we have this charged fulcrum of resistance that we can apply our little energies to this huge idea called oppression. And that together, pushing at these different points along these different fronts, we will affect the change, some change, maybe some change, a little change. Somebody, everybody wants some change. I think that, like, it's time to be utopian again. I think it's time to say, you know, what is the best possible freaking world I can give my children and grandchildren? Okay, let's start. It's warless. It's rapeless. I have daughters and granddaughters. It's rapeless. Poverty, that's over. So there's no hunger. Disease, well, bodies are going to fail. But, you know, healthcare should be like, you know, they don't have, you know what I mean? Like this mentality where everything is privatized. We get rid of all of that. We get rid of the idea that this thing that we've built together and everybody's been building it for hundreds of years, everybody's parents were building a different part of it. The idea that the only fuel it can run on is greed and selfishness. We just get rid of it. We don't have any debates about like communism and capitalism or whatever. We don't really need a state if we're families again. We don't need it. We don't need it. So I try to get people just to up the level of the dialogue. Everybody to me is aiming too low. These issues. I don't think in terms of issues. I think in terms of there's a way of that things are being done on this planet that has to stop. And that's the issue. And I don't really think it's a project that we're going to be successful just going out and doing. I think we have to become the being that can live that world. And that's a complicated process that we're not, it's not, you know, it's not entirely under our control. So a lot of what I'm trying to do artistically, by strategically and empirically muddying, disrupting, and meddling, and tinkering, and hacking at the symbolic infrastructure that we build our myths with and all of the other subsequent meanings. You know, a lot of what I'm trying to do is catalytic. It's trying to just create lower the threshold for a process that I think we've been moving towards for a long time. You know, it's evolutionary, man. It's good. It's a good thing. It's a good thing.
Makes me think of a saying that I saw the other day that said, Everyone's so focused on trying to leave a better planet for our kids. We should be more focused on leaving better kids for our planet. And I really resonate with that, becoming the solution and leading by example, because energy is contagious.
I have this movie treatment for a sci-fi flick. And it's kind of like just a variation on, like, you know, the old, one of the more familiar tropes, body snatcher kind of tropes. But the children start disappearing on planet Earth, one at a time, two at a time, three at a time. They're disappearing. And it's a crisis, it's a crisis, it's a crisis. And finally, like, the aliens show up and they say, well, yeah, we're raising them for you. You guys couldn't do it. What do you mean? We're trying to help you out, you know? One generation of children raised, do you know what I'm saying, with love and respect and gentleness. Oh my gosh, what would that mean?
That's the future, man. So
that's the future.
Talk to us about some of this Afrofuturism.
Afrofuturism is everybody's futurism. Did I say that loud enough? Afrofuturism is everybody's futurism. That's why it's here right now. Okay, it's not just about black liberation. It's about black people and indigenous people are the canary component of the human population. Can I make that clear? Like the canary that goes down in the mine to let you know when the air has become too funky to breathe. If you want to get to a sustainable world, it'll be a world where black young people aren't afraid of whatever law enforcement is, because it won't exist like it does now. We won't even have that concept of like police. And the indigenous can live in harmony with the land as they have for tens and thousands of years. That's the bottom line. So Afrofuturism is a future where black people survive. And if we're surviving and thriving, the world is all right. We're the canary component of this human family. That's why we've had it so bad, just to let you know how bad things are being done here.
So Thomas Stanley Bushmeat, you've written a book or maybe more. Could you tell us about your recent book?
Well, I'm going to work from the beginning forward. I'm co-author along with David Mills and Larry Alexander, who lives very close to here, by the way, of a book called, I left out Eris Wilson, fourth co-author, of a book called George Clinton and P-Funk and Oral History. So for 18 months, 2 years, I got to follow my favorite, you know, funk band around for, you know, just everywhere they went. In 2014, in conjunction with the 100th anniversary of Sun Ra's birth, I self-published a work called The Execution of Sun Ra. And the title is basically a play on something that Sun Ra used to, you know, he had these equations, he called them, these word games, these language games, where he would draw our attention to the dual meaning and the dual usage of common words. So he had this thing where he would say, you know, execute. Execute means a couple of things. It means to put a plan into action, and it means to kill a man. And he points to historical Jesus and says, yeah, when they executed him, they put his plan in action. So I saw my work as part of putting Sun Ra's plan in action, Sun Ra's plan about progress, about development. You know, about development. I'm working on a project now that is the continuation of the execution of Sun Ra. I'm really, really excited about it. It's been really hard, and it's really different. It's an interactive workbook that will allow the reader, the user, the recipient to create their own language to define what is beyond the horizon of the future. You know, we're trying to evolve beyond the future as a cheap marketing construct. You know, like when I grew up, you know, I'm from like the 70s and 60s, and it was like, you know, the future was just everywhere. The idea of the future, the idea of someday taking all your meals and pills and flying cars, and I'm in the future now. Hey, this is not the future that we know. So, you know, there's an authentic future that this one is kind of masking and obscuring. And You know, the idea is, well, what can we do to kind of get over the hump? Because that's where the good stuff is. It's stateless. Did I say that? It's stateless. There is no, you know, all of these structures we've put in place based on the assumption that the human being is, you know, original sin. It has to be punished and coerced into obedience and good behavior. All of those paradigms collapse at once, and we start standing on our 2 feet like responsible beings. And it's such a big change, and it should not be taken as a return to something we've already done. This is way better than that. We've been through history, which was a war, a kick-ass war, a spiritual war. And on the other side of it, we should be different. A different being. You know, maybe human being will be too small a word for us to use. But that's, I think we're right on the cusp of that. I think that's the instability and the interconnectedness of the global system makes this possible. And I'm just working as an artist. I'm working with the tools that I've got in my hands to try to get it there, you know?
Dang, do you talk about this stuff on your radio show?
I just play music, honest to God.
He's also a professor, right?
I mean, it's too late in the evening for me to try to like really like freestyle.
Yeah.
And I love music. So I want to create a radio show where when you listen to the music, you feel like this. That's what I'm doing.
So Stanley, you've also, you know, worked at some prestigious institutions, like for example, being a professor at Princeton. You want to talk
No. I would love to be a professor at Princeton.
Really?
If anyone's listening at Princeton, but I was a professor.
George Mason.
At
right?
George Mason University, yes.
Well, yes. Sebi told me Princeton this morning. So that's
Sebi, so he's my friend.
By the way, Sebi is a mutual friend of Thomas's and ours, and is also a roommate here in Tacoma, you know, where we're living, and creating a lot of magic. Mm-hmm. But I'd like to hear you speak about George Mason and the program you started there.
Sound art. I got hired to teach hip hop, and I taught hip hop for a while, and there was this move to make a new building, and I kind of connived my way into making a sound studio in this new building. You know, the building's plans were going up, and it really came to me, and they said, well, if you were going to make us a studio, what would you do? And I kind of said, well, I'd do this. And so in a space that was not a lot bigger than this, I put in a sound installation booth. I put in a 24-track Mackie board. I put in some computers and Pro Tools, and just kind of said, let's have fun. And, you know, this is what I think is important. We clandestinely renamed the studio after one of George Mason's captive black people. We don't call my ancestors slaves anymore, because that legitimizes a system that was never at any point legitimate, right? So this man's name was Mulatto Dick. That was his name, if you want to call it a name. And he ran away twice. And the second time, Mason was like, well, you know, what's up? You keep running away. So the magistrate said, well, you know what we can do, George Mason, sir, is we can take this guy that you can't seem to keep in place. We can nail his ear to a fence post and then whack it off with a machete. And George Mason, I mean, I don't know, he signed some important documents about freedom and human rights. He said, hell yeah, cut that motherfucker's ear off. And so we renamed the studio Dick's Ear Studio. At George Mason University, we did lots of recordings clandestinely that went out and are out there in the world, Dick's Ear Studio, because of that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
Man, I like. I'm really interested in what you're talking about, sound art, and just really everything in general. Where would you say majority of your inspiration comes from, and how do you continue to stay inspired?
You know, what are some of the books you've read as well?
Oh boy. Well, you know, I mentioned Sun Ra, and Sun Ra is huge, and Sun Ra is an immeasurable equation, which is also the title of one of his larger anthologies of poetry and essays. You know, somewhere along the line, it got really not cool to cite white males, especially really hegemonic white males, as your, you know, your influences. So I guess I should just stop. I kind of like Terrence McKenna, you know.
Nice.
Baruch Spinoza. In fact, we should just get all the white guys out of the way and then name some other people.
Terrence McKenna is more of an interdimensional being.
White guy, Scottish, you know. Rashida Phillips, Black Quantum Futurism. Toni Morrison, there we go. Toni Morrison's beloved. I've never talked about this. Oh yeah, I'm gonna get on axis, sorry. Toni Morrison's beloved, Toni Morrison, absolutely one of the most important living American writers and arguably one of the most important American authors of all time, from Lorain, Ohio. I'm from Ohio. I've heard her read once, and it was, you know, it was amazing. So, Toni Morrison's book, Beloved, is the story about what happened in America between African people and the Europeans that presume to own them. It's the part of that story that neither side had an interest in remembering and retelling. We have never really thought about what it would mean to have a class of human beings who had absolutely zero legal protections and were not really considered anything other than property. I try to be a really nice guy. I try to think of myself as a disciplined guy. I'm not sure who I would be if you gave me 100 nubile young women and said you owned them. Well, they're just here to pick cotton now. That's all they're supposed to be doing, but they're yours. And if anything gets out of hand, what's going to happen? It's the story, Beloved, of how horrifying the treatment was that black people had to endure as their, you know, entry pass into the American dream. Now, I had an experience. I had an experience while I was living at Woodburn Hill Farm. It might have been in about, memory. Let's say the early 90s. And I was working a lot with psilocybin at the time. And I know everybody's heard of Baba Kalindi E's 30-gram, you know, mega doses of mushrooms. That's large, way large. But I thought I was doing large doses down, like, you know, 5-7 grams. I thought that was like, wow, that's a lot of mushrooms. So I had a particular experience where I just wanted to do mushrooms and be on the land at this farm where I was living. And I set it up in a way that I would, you know, maximize the connection of body to spirit. And you know, respecting the mushrooms is really important. They're people. They can hurt you. They can hurt you even if you do respect them. And if you disrespect them, they will definitely hurt you. And they may not hurt you the first time you disrespect them, being very similar to women like that.
People, too.
People.
In general.
So respect the mushroom people. So I had an experience with the mushrooms where I actually relived one of the characters, one of the key characters. I don't think I want to get into how, you know, one of the key characters who was involved in this story of this horrific abuse. And, you know, I kind of lived out in my space. I lived out all of the things that he was going through and his anxieties and I didn't come through it. See, that part of it was very bad. It was hard. It was difficult. And I didn't come through it until I had this revelation about nature and the animals there. Because I was way deep in the woods, and I was having this, you know, fairly bad experience of identification with what had happened. I mean, I was on a farm in southern Maryland. I had no idea how many similar horrors had unfolded 150, 200 years earlier there. So I'm in the thick of it, and I look up, and I'm surrounded by animals. I'm surrounded by nature. I'm surrounded by birds, and there's, you know, there's hawks, and just... And it dawned on me that the animals keep their distance from human beings because they think we're... It's not just that they're afraid of us. They think we're impure. We bust up their vibe. They have a vibe where they're always, you know, down in their focused appreciation of what it means to be a squirrel or a deer or a heron or a fox. You know, they're always in that. And people bust that up. And we bust it up for each other. And I had this feeling of like, you know, I went right through this misery of being less than a human being to being something other than a human being. And it felt very liberated. You know, and then, you know, shortly thereafter that, I put my clothes back on and returned to the world, you know. But, yeah, I never told that story before. Wow. Yeah.
Thank you.
That makes me think of the book Mycelium Running. If you want to learn some very science-based information about psilocybin mushrooms and how they're connected on all continents, underneath oceans even, Mycelium Running.
Okay. Okay, yeah. Good. Thank you.
What are some books that you get a lot of your like inspiration and knowledge from?
I thought I just answered that.
You said Sunrise. So
I said Beloved.
Thank you. Perfect.
Yeah.
So Bushmeat, is it cool if I call you Bushmeat?
Sure it is. Yeah.
What are some upcoming projects that you've got?
The new book is going to be dope. I'm also working on a remix. I had a meeting with Luke Stewart. Oh, I mentioned a name, and that means I have negated all the other great people that I work with. I apologize to everyone. He's a great guy and does work in non-idiomatic improvised music and does a lot to kind of energize and hold community together. And I've done a lot of collaborations with Luke, and one of the things that was recorded at Dick Sears Studio, he's given me permission to remix it. So it's a solo acoustic bass piece that I'm starting. I've just kind of sort of teased the material apart that I'll be putting back together in a way that becomes something new, you know? Wow. That's you know, all things new. That's where we're going, all things new.
Do you like Victor Wooten?
Victor Wooten is cool. I'll be honest with you, I'm kind of, I'm very far down the rabbit hole. Victor Wooten is very cool. Yeah. You know, I interviewed Bootsy and like, you know.
Oh, nice.
Victor's got a real nice collabo on Bootsy's last Worldwide Funk album. See, that's like two names. And all bassists. I've only mentioned bass players today.
Yeah. I was going to say, Victor Wooten, like, he wrote a book also.
Twin Chewed is a local artist, and I just mentioned her on your podcast. And she sings. And she also plays keyboards. And I think she does modules in addition to the keyboards. And she has the most wonderful tonal quality, not just to her voice, but the way that her voice integrates with her work. Mm-hmm. And I also have an invitation from her to be on her next album. And that's why I mentioned her.
Nice.
So that's coming down the track. And here's another artist, Khalid Thompson. Does live painting with musicians playing and improvising, right? So he's painting in response to the music that's being generated on the stage, and the audience is soaking it all up. So Khalid has asked me as something different, as a variation on this idea, to come in and find a venue and do a thing where I just kind of improvise like I'm doing right now, talking. No music, and then he paints to that, and that's what he asked me to do.
Wow!
So those are three ongoing, upcoming projects, and if I thought more, I'd probably think of more, and then I'd get really tired.
What instruments do you play mostly?
I play electrons, and they're very small, yeah. And it makes it hard to do, and fast. Damn, they fast.
So how do you do that? I want to learn how to play electrons.
If it was easy. You know, everybody would do it. That's right.
Well, you play bass. I mean, it sounds like your voice is one of your...
No,
just electrons.
I like I don't want to get myself in too much trouble. There's controversy, and then there's like, I got to have some friends. I try to avoid that, because I can't play anything well that has a traditional, like, structure or interface. Mm. So I try to play things where I can improvise and totally sidestep, the whole chromatic thing. Like, I try to sidestep that. I'm trying real hard, and this has been like an uphill battle. I like swing and I like groove. And it's hard to not think in a duple sort of way, because it's up, down, up, down, up, down, and it's very symmetrical. And that symmetry, musically, is hard to shake off with a three, because you'll find yourself turning your threes into twos, really. So I'm trying to get into a world where the rhythms are based on prime numbers and not just multiples of two, you know, four, four, and, you know.
Polyrhythms.
Yeah, really complicated polyrhythms, you know. Polyrhythms where, like, the point where they repeat and line up again may not happen for thousands of years, you know. But to start it now and then see where it's going to be, you know, in a little while, you know.
That just, like, blew up my music theory brain into pieces.
Well, you've got a quote here, Stanley. Correct me if I'm wrong. Is it altered destiny equals noetic revolution?
Yes.
Can you explain that to the listeners?
Well, yes.
He looked at the time like, goodness, do we have enough time?
Altered destiny, first of all, altered destiny is Sun Ra's, you know, Sun Ra was this huge being, this huge creative force, and I like to think of him as a pyramid, you know. And the absolute peak, the pinnacle, I believe, of his work, of his mission with human beings, is altered destiny. And Sun Ra talked about altered destiny as what we would be doing if we weren't kind of addicted to this. And when you kind of interrogate Sun Ra about what altered destiny is, he slides out of the way such that you cannot reduce it to any kind of, you really can't equate what he calls altered destiny with any very specific kind of social change, policy, you know. It's not about a collection of new ideas per se, but it's about like a new zone of time where symbols can be unleashed in a very, very different way. I think, like, altered destiny is, according to Thomas Stanley, I think that altered destiny is very similar to the singularity that Terence McKenna was talking about. And I think it's really something in the tissue of not just natural language, the language we're using to communicate right now, the language that is synced up with the sound of our bodies and our voice, but I think it's all of this symbolic activity is basically happening on the same mainframe, and it's starting to hybridize and interact and spark little chimera and oddities in a way that we can't really, you know, we can't put it back in the box. So I think altered destiny is kind of like an accident that happens in languaging behavior, that broad category of stuff where we use symbols to stand in for other things. And I think that when that happens, since a lot of what regulates our consciousness, our awareness, our minds, our thinking is language, the worlds that we create from our thoughts is mediated by language, everything changes. You know, everything changes. Everything changes. Okay? So, noetic revolution. Noetic is that. Noetic is ideas about the mind and consciousness before we go up to the level of ideology and knowledge and all that stuff. You know, you can contest all that stuff. You can't contest the immediacy of experience. You know, there's stuff about consciousness that, you know, all this sophisticated science doesn't seem to be able to get at. I think we get at it real soon, and we get at it kind of accidentally. You know, I think maybe there's like some children's game being played on a playground in like Johannesburg, and the kids play this game with words. Maybe it's not even words, maybe it's just mouth noises. And as they do it, they get a high. And it's a special high, a deathless high. You know, so much of what we do is predicated on our fear of death. We build a world of monuments to celebrate people and to really because we want monuments built for us, you know. It's backwards. You know, the future takes people that aren't afraid of physical death. And if you have some knowledge, you don't have to be afraid. So there's this game and these children are playing this game. And the adults come by and they say, what are they doing? And the adults say, let's try it. And the adults catch the high. And it's like, whoa, that's it. You know, that's through this trick of language, I've achieved what yogis and gurus and people ascend, you know, don't climb up to the Himalayas. The meditation caves are at the base. You don't have to go up that high, but you don't have to do any of that stuff. Through this simple permutation of language, something like enlightenment, something like, you know, a new unfolding of what consciousness can do. You know, consciousness, awareness, it establishes our relationship to the world. You know, the world, that's all we have is our consciousness of the world. We don't have the world. So if that changes, we get the world in a different way. And then we live in that for 12,000 years probably. Mm. And then they cycle us through some other shit.
Would you say it's similar to manifestation and the power that lies there?
I'd say it's similar to the ice caps retreating and all that fertile land opening up underneath that ice. And being able to drop a seed and it grows like that. And yeah, and just so much abundance that brotherhood and sisterhood, it just comes naturally. I'd say it's like that. I'd say it's like a ghost dance. I'd say it's like rolling back a buffalo carpet and finding all the dead underneath that have been slain by this system. And all the deaths, you understand at the end of it, all of it was necessary. Like we had to go through history to get as good as we're getting ready to be. Don't get caught up on like vengeance. Ah, vengeance. Look what they did to us. Oh, they deprived us. They did this. They did that. It's over. It's over and we transcend it. You're not going to get even. You're not going to get everybody wants to blow up the world so that they can get even. Okay. I mean, I have days like that, but it ain't going to work. Transcend it. You move past it. And then we do other stuff. And then that, we exhaust that. We exhaust that frame. And lo and behold, it's like, wow, you know, 12,000 years from now, they're electing some, you know, fuckwad that's as bad or worse than Trump. And it's like, wow, things are really getting weird. I guess it's time for another big change.
Wow.
You know, big changes, big changes, big changes in consciousness, how it settles into the world. This is old consciousness. This consciousness was made to make money and waste time. And you heard that here.
Wow. Thank you, Stanley, so much for I mean, I've learned like 10 times over in this one chat than I have in the last year. But
yeah, this conversation could go on all day, man. And I know we both have things to do and places to see. So we'll maybe have you on the podcast again, hopefully sometime.
You guys do a very good job of getting me to talk.
Yeah, right on. Well, that's the point. Yeah. We just kind of let you talk. So where can people get connected with you, internet, in person?
I do it on my webpage, musicovermind.org, musicovermind.org. All right. I'm a programmer at WPFWFM.org, and I'm heard every week, Thursdays at midnight until 2 a.m., on Friday, the dankest 2 hours of music program you have ever heard.
Yes. Dr. Thomas Bushmeat Stanley. Thank you so much.
Thank you, John.
And again, this is the MetaMakers podcast. If you want to stay up to date with our events and the things we've got going on, check out some other podcasts. You can go online at metacreative.world, metacreative.world, collaborative arts, inspiring sustainability. Thanks for listening.
Right. Thank you.